All right, so this is last of our fundamental teachings classes on the Bodhisattva path. So this one should be fun. And a little easier. It just is inspiring, but a little bit easier to grasp than some of the classes. So I'm going to start with a little kind of a little story of the evolution of the Bodhisattva ideal and the Bodhisattva path in Buddhism. So in original Buddhism, generally the only, so you know, the kind of the oldest texts that we have represented by the Pali Canon, not exclusively, but so that is the canon treasured by Theravadin Buddhism. The word bodhisattva is in there, but it is re it refers generally to Shakyamuni Buddha in his previous lives. So the bodhisattva is somebody striving for Buddhahood. And so, you know, in the Indian cosmology, the idea of there was a rebirth. And so the Buddha, for many lifetimes, he says that he was reborn and he kept on working on himself. And then, so it didn't just start in the one lifetime, right? That he had built up much merit and done much training. And a lot of these stories about his previous lives are about him being incredibly altruistic and selfless. So there's the Jataka tales are stories of the Buddha's previous lives, and they're not technically part of the Pali Canon, and actually they think some of them actually predate even the Buddha himself. But anyway, like you might have heard the story of, like, in a previous life the Buddha was, I can't remember, I don't think he was a person, maybe he was a person, but sometimes he's a deer or something like that. But anyway, there was a hungry tigress who was starving and she needed to feed her cubs. So he threw himself off a cliff so she could eat him and feed her cubs.
Wow.
So it's like stories like that, you know, is extreme altruism. But also the other kind of paramitas, like real generosity and kindness, stuff like that. So I ran across an interesting article by Bhikkhu Bodhi on the Access to Insight website. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is a Theravadan monk, and he was kind of telling this because there's this an oversimplification of the story that essentially, in original Buddhism, the way the Buddha taught, he taught people a certain path to awakening, and they would, you know, do this diligent practice, this meditation and study, and you know, the successful ones would achieve arhat status. And that meant that they were not going to be reborn again. There were different levels of attainment, right? So if you got a certain level of attainment, that meant you were eventually gonna become an arhat. You know, in some life, some future life, you were guaranteed. But I mean, you didn't know how long it was gonna take. And some it was, oh, you're gonna take two more lifetimes, or you're gonna take one more lifetime. You're not going to come back. The arhats are like, you know, that's it. This lifetime is the last. So they achieve nirvana, and they're very respected. And so that is what is portrayed in, like, the Pali Canon is practitioners achieving that level of attainment, and then they would, you know, they would teach others and be respected. And then that kind of the oversimplification is that then Mahayana Buddhism arose later on and began elevating the Bodhisattva ideal. So instead of the Bodhisattva being like the path for spiritual athletes, like not just arhats, but like you're going for Buddhahood. Like, so instead of it being like this kind of extreme athletic path, it became the aspiration we should all have. So it's a very interesting evolution. But then the stereotype is kind of like the Mahayana Buddhists We're all in for the Bodhisattva, and just, I don't know, all we do is go around trying to do good for other beings and kind of neglect practice, neglect enlightenment. Like, we don't really care about that anymore, just go around doing good. And then the simplification of the original Buddhism being that you kind of a bunch of selfish arhats who don't care about anybody. So he's trying to unpack this a little bit with real respect for both sides. So he was bringing out how, so the Buddha, when he started teaching, that his students, some of them attained this arhat status and they were described, but the Buddha was distinguished, he was differentiated from these other arhats. He was going into that. He said, to bring out the difference, I want to take two stock formulas that occur many times in the texts, one for the Buddha and one for the arhats, the other arhats. The formula for the arhat reads thus: here is a monk or a layperson, here is someone who is an arhat, one whose taints are destroyed, who has lived the spiritual life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, one completely liberated through final knowledge. So then here's a formulation, a description of the Buddha, also called the Blessed One. The Blessed One is an arhat, a perfectly enlightened one, possessed of true knowledge and conduct, an exalted one, a knower of the world, unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas, gods, and humans, enlightened, the Blessed One. So Bhikkhu Bodhi says there are nine epithets here. Of these nine, four are also used for arhat disciples: arhat, possessed of true knowledge and conduct, an exalted one, enlightened. Now, five are used exclusively for the Buddha: perfectly enlightened one, knower of the world, unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the Blessed One. So note that of these five, two refer explicitly to the Buddha's significance for others. So the Buddha can function so effectively as a teacher because his attainment of enlightenment brings along, this is according to the tradition, the acquisition of several other types of knowledge that are considered special assets of a Buddha. Chief among these, according to the oldest sources, are the 10 Tathagata powers, which include the knowledge of the diverse inclinations of beings and the knowledge of the degree of maturity of the faculties of other beings. So such types of knowledge enable the Buddha to understand the mental proclivities and capacities of any person who comes to him for guidance, and to teach that person in a particular way that will prove most beneficial, taking full account of his or her character and personal circumstances. The Buddha is thus the unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed. So it's curious, as Bhikkhu Bodhi points out, that in original Buddhism, so there's this interesting tension, because in original Buddhism, the Buddha taught, his explicit teachings are essentially about how to become an arhat. There are some things in there about like metta practice and ethical behavior and stuff like that, but it is almost always phrased in terms of like, this is a prerequisite for spiritual practice. It's not like, do it out of love for all the beings. It's like, how do you expect to reach deep states of meditation and insight if you're, being selfish and mean, right? So it's a very pragmatic approach to morality and generosity. So he did not teach, as far as we can tell, the Bodhisattva path. I mean, he encourages people to share the Dharma once they learn it, and that is considered the greatest gift. Yet the Buddha had followed the Bodhisattva path himself, right? He had spent supposedly lifetimes cultivating this deep altruism, and he is described as once he decided to teach, that he was so he was like 30 years old, and then he died at around 80. They say he was never alone for 50 years. So he never turned anyone away. He was constantly teaching. It describes him as just being like this masterful teacher, right? Just always compassionate, always patient. So Bhikkhu Bodhi was writing and saying, you know, if, maybe in reality there wasn't that much difference between the Buddha and his arhat disciples, but he says, this position seems to strip away from the Buddha that which is most distinctive about him. His uncanny ability to reach deep into the hearts of those who came to him for guidance and teach them in a unique way suitable for their characters and situations. This ability betokens a depth of compassion, a spirit of selfless service that harmonizes better with the later concept of the Bodhisattva than with the canonical concept of the Arhat as we see it portrayed. So there's this kind of this Buddha as example, right? There's the kind of the explicit teachings over here, but then if you look at the actions and the kind of the personal interactions of the Buddha, there's another message being communicated. So this then there's this evolution, which different people have different ways of describing it, but over several hundred years after the Buddha's death, there's different schools of Buddhism start to emerge. And a matter of fact, it was really more like different approaches. At first, it wasn't even schools. It was just, I don't know, like within one sangha, right? I'm doing the Arhat thing, and Coral's like, I don't know. I feel like I wanna serve all beings, right? And then it would just be kind of like an individual difference in practice. But eventually, Bhikkhu Bodhi describes this as a gradual shift in emphasis from the historical Buddha as wise human teacher to kind of a Buddha principle. So it becomes more of like a principle of enlightenment. There evolved the idea that there had been multiple Buddhas, there had been past Buddhas. Shakyamuni Buddha was just the most recent example of a human being awakening. Oh, then you start dreaming up, you know, there's Buddhas in alternate universes. There's all kinds of Buddhas. So it starts like getting very imaginative. And then there's more emphasis on those previous life stories of the Buddha, right? There's a particular like, let's go back and study those, where he's full of moral restraint and self-sacrifice. So then there later developed the sense that there were three paths to awakening. So there was the Arhat, there was the solitary enlightened one who attains realization without a teacher but does not teach. So I think these are like they're called a Pratyeka Buddha, and I think of this as like, we can encounter, in a way, kind of enlightened people in all different walks of life. But what differentiates them from a Buddha is like a Buddha has a path that you can follow. Whereas a Pratyeka Buddha is usually like they've tread their own unique, wacky path. Like you can't be them, right? You can't have lived their life and dabbled in all they've dabbled in, right? But they could be very awakened. They just don't have the path that you can share. And then the Bodhisattva path. So Bhikkhu Bodhi describes like, clearly those who were interested in the Bodhisattva path needed to create some scriptures about the Bodhisattva path. And it was never viewed that the other scriptures and writings were not legitimate, right? They were all like, yeah, that's really good descriptions of ways to practice, but also wanted to address this Bodhisattva aspiration. But it is essential to realize that the Bodhisattva path is not just about do-gooding. It also involves diligent practice and an aspiration to awaken to reality. In particular, the wisdom of Prajnaparamita of emptiness. And so it's described as the Bodhisattva, even while selflessly working for beings, does not conceive of there is an I here who is helping those beings over there. Like, it's like a flow of compassion, a natural response, but not becoming attached to those ideas. So here's a description, classic description of Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva path in the Diamond Sutra. So the disciple Subhuti asks the Buddha, if a noble son or daughter should set forth on the Bodhisattva path, how should they behave? How should they practice? And how should they control their thoughts? So the Buddha explained, and this isn't the only thing he says, but this is a real classic piece. Subhuti, those who would now set forth on the Bodhisattva path should think this thought. However many beings there are in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they are born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they are able to perceive or not perceive, or neither perceive nor not perceive. In whatever inconceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of unconditioned nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not? Subhuti, a bodhisattva to whom the conception of a being occurs cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why is that? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who conceives of a being, a life, or a soul. So, I mean, this is a, I think this is a teaching about a way of being in the world that is not, I mean, if you can grasp it intellectually, it's not very helpful, right? It kind of has to be lived. What does that really mean? I think a classic example, I'm sure it's not the only one, but for me, having gotten interested in climate activism, there's this sense of being motivated to help, to respond to suffering, to save whatever I can. But as long as there is a sense of like, I need to do something, and I'm contemplating all of those suffering beings over there and all of that, like, it is a recipe for burnout is one way to put it. It's like, and even if we don't burn out, it's a very stressful position to be in, and one that really encourages, I don't know, encourages anger, encourages like a fixation on particular outcomes. It's, yeah. So, I mean, it doesn't have to be just activism, right? But anything, if you're trying to help your family, if you're trying to do any kind of good in the world. So what does it mean now? You put the other side, right, might be just like about not caring and not doing and not taking responsibility. So clearly, if we're supposed to save every last being, right? We're supposed to aspire to save. Doesn't matter if they can perceive. So I mean, we're talking about bugs and slugs, let alone human beings and every last person. We are supposed to be motivated to save and free them. So that, we're being asked to care that much and to take that much, in a way, to take that much responsibility. I like to say that the Bodhisattva never says, "Not my problem." Even if we recognize there's a limit to what we can do or offer in a given circumstance, we never like close our heart and just go, "Well, I'm doing enough." I mean, because you can never do enough, right? But that compassion and that care and that urge to generosity is balanced with the wisdom that we gain through practice. So thus we come to our fourfold Bodhisattva vow. So beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. So beings are numberless, I vow to free them all is applied, implied. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them all. Again, I never get to the point where it's just like, well, I got rid of a lot of my delusions. Now the rest are fine. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. So, like, you may have had this experience actually in practice so far, where it's like you want to enter the Dharma gate, like enter that Dharma gate, but it's like, where is it? Like, what? It's everywhere. It's everything, right? So it's not just, it's not like, oh, there's the Dharma gate over there. Entered that one. Like, it does not how it works, right? And yet we carry that aspiration. And then the Buddha way is unsurpassable, like inconceivable, but I vow to like embody it completely. So in this book, Living by Vow by Shokaku Okumura, he talks about these vows. It's a whole chapter on them. And it's very, I just think what he says is very sweet. So I thought I'd share it. So he's talking about the word vow and how in English it has some connotations that it doesn't in Japanese. So anyway, he says, from the beginning, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, vow is essential for all bodhisattvas. In fact, part of the definition of a bodhisattva is a person who lives by vow instead of by karma. Karma means habit, preferences, or a ready-made system of values. As we grow up, we learn a system of values from the culture around us, which we use to evaluate the world and choose actions. This is karma and living by karma. In contrast, a bodhisattva lives by vow. Vow is like a magnet or compass that shows us the direction toward the Buddha. There is a basic contradiction between the first and second half of each sentence. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. But if sentient beings are numberless, we cannot possibly save them all. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. If they're inexhaustible, how can I do this? It's logically impossible. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. If they are boundless, we cannot completely master them. The contradiction in the fourth vow is subtler. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. If it's so transcendent, can we really expect to realize it? These contradictions are very important and have a profound practical and religious meaning. We vow to do things that are impossible. This means that our practice is endless, and we cannot completely fulfill the four vows. Our practice and study are like trying to empty the ocean with a spoon, one spoonful at a time. It is certainly a stupid way of life, not a very clever one. A clever person cannot be a bodhisattva. We are aiming at something eternal, infinite, and absolute. No matter how hard we practice, study, and help other people, there is no end to it all. When we compare our achievement with something infinite, absolute, and eternal, it's like nothing. There's another side to this. Even if we cannot practice as hard, sit as long, study as much, or understand as deeply as others, we don't need to feel guilty or inferior. Compared to the eternal, the absolute, or the infinite, we are all equal to zero. There is something deeply meaningful in our comparison with the absolute. Understanding ourselves in this way frees our practice from competition based on selfishness. This is a most important point. We cannot be proud of our practice, and we don't need to be too humble about our lack of practice or understanding. We are just as we are. Our practice is to take one more step toward the infinite, the absolute, moment by moment, one step at a time. So I wanted to invite you all to imagine that you arrived at Zen practice, you arrived at this Zen center or wherever you encountered Zen for the first time. And you've studied everything that we've studied so far, anicca, anatta, dukkha, and emptiness and suchness and Buddha nature and all of that. And then we just there was no bodhisattva vow, right? There was no, and we could cover precepts, but we could do it in that pragmatic way. Right, just like kind of moral discipline as a way to lead a peaceful life and be able to develop spiritual understanding because you make a mess of your life when you're not behaving ethically. So just kind of imagine what our practice, what our sangha would be like, what our sense of path would be like without the bodhisattva vow. Or you can say something about the bodhisattva vow too, whatever. Jen.
So maybe it would be like coming to it from the angle of liberating all beings from our conceiving of them as bound in their own little confines. So we're liberating them in our mind by our practice. And then when we experience them, we're not experiencing them as other.
Yeah, and I mean that's actually how the Theravadins would describe their practice. I mean, I once had a discussion with a Theravadin practitioner because about the altruism, the like we kind of like we follow the precepts because I'm like we realize we're interdependent with all things. We're separate from you. And if I hurt you, I hurt myself. Like that kind of thing. They don't do that, right? They're like, look, if I steal and lie and cheat, that's just encouraging self-attachment and it's going to get in the way of my spiritual practice, But it's not really like mutually exclusive, right? Even if all we did was work on ourselves in that way. Somebody like I think it was Chosen and said, we vow to free all beings from ourselves. That's a good start. That's a really good start, just to freeing beings from our own kind of selfishness and delusion and stuff. Yoli.
So, oh my gosh, I just fell. Oh, here. Oh, sorry. What is it? I'm guilty. So Robert Thurman, Robert Thurman, he's, so he made a point that's kind of makes me giggle, which is imagine yourself, I don't know if I've brought this up before, imagine yourself stuck in a subway. And the subway stops and it's dark. And imagine being stuck with all these people that are just like you and you can't stand yourself. And I always think about that because it's like, okay, that's totally makes sense. I mean, you want to be better so that the people around you are also better. Because if you're not better, then you're just stuck with more of you know? So anyways.
That's an interesting
go to your chair.
mental exercise.
Well, what is this, guys?
Just like
It's tea. It's like a host
so it may not look so dark once it dries.
Yeah, I'll go.
Maybe she gets some water.
We're just mopping up tea, so we can.
Yeah.
So how do you, oh yeah, Mark.
This is almost evading the question. So why did I come off mute? But I feel like if you studied all of the previous entries in this class, but there was no Bodhisattva path, you'd just end up inventing it, right? Like, there's no self. Everything is impermanent. Everything is empty, but I still have to live a life. What's worth doing? Is it going to be some trivial, self-satisfying thing that vanishes with me? What wake do I want to leave in the world? If nothing else, why not do something beautiful?
Like that. I think I would really miss the Bodhisattva vow and the ideal of the path. Even if kind of by practice and implication, there ended up being, us like selfishness getting out of the way and dependent co-arising, what have you. But this kind of amazingly ambitious, loving aspiration, it just goes so far beyond just a sense of like no longer feeling separate from people, right? I would imagine that, the people in your life, most of whom probably do not really understand anything about your Zen practice, probably think, hey, right, like you're the people who meditate, and then maybe they'll know something about letting go of suffering or something like that. But, beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them all. I mean, I don't know. Sounds kind of crazy to me. Sounds kind of fanatical or over the top, or I don't know. But Tyler.
Yeah, I guess you just sort of reminded me of what I've known. You know, we all know lots of different religions and spiritual paths and stuff like that. But I was one of the things that always kind of irked, maybe not irked, but like maybe like less interested was that so many of them were like, "You're doing this thing as an individual, so you can go to heaven," and like whatever happens to the rest of them, like whatever, you're going to heaven, right? Like this is like screw everyone else. That's where I'm headed. You know, you guys can come if you want, but that's not my problem. Which is maybe not actually how all other spiritual people in other religions view it, but it was enough to kind of keep. That's how I saw it being enacted, or I thought it did. It kept me away from pursuing or any sort of organized religion, organized spirituality. And then I think it was when I learned about the Bodhisattva vow, and I was like, oh, okay, so this is some, you know, there wasn't some sort of, there isn't some kind of heaven thing that I can just go do my own thing and get there all on my own. There was like, you know, we're here and we're trying to like, what that out, that analogy of letting everyone on the elevator before you, I think that you've used before or whatever. It was just like, I don't know, that wasn't, you know, that was what really tied me in. So I'm not sure if, yeah, without it, I don't know what, yeah, it just wouldn't be what I was looking for, I don't think.
Thank you. Leah.
Yeah, can you hear me? Okay, good. So I like to think of it as just infinitely expansive. So like for an example of beings are numberless. I vow to free them all. So they, if I think about it in terms of, well, let's just start with a number, like 100. Right. And then, okay, those 100 beings. Okay, I vow to free them all. And then think maybe, okay, let's think bigger. How about 100,000? Okay, 100,000 beings. That seems like a lot of work, but, you know, I could do that. I could do that. And then if the more I think about it, the more I inflate the number. And then it just starts to be this expansive feeling where it doesn't really matter, I guess, anymore about there being a specific number of anything. It's just a feeling of infinite expansion, I guess. That's how I think of it.
I like that. Erica and then Denny.
Yeah, just to kind of piggyback on that, so I used to practice a lot of yoga, and I think the Swami Vivekananda, I don't remember who now, but there was somebody who was famous for saying, "Practice and all is coming." And I remember asking a yoga teacher, what is all? What is he talking about? She's like, "Well, I don't know." And that's kind of how I feel about this too. It's like, well, we don't know what it all is, but we just keep practicing. And there's some nobility to that, and there's purpose in that, even if, you know, there's no like end goal, right? There's no like, yes, you've freed everybody and everything, and it's like you just keep going.
Yeah, it's not like the Dharma gates are like, okay, well, there's a library, and then like, you know, there's 100 volumes, and so you need to master all those, you know. We can't know.
Right.
Denny.
I really like this question, and I love all these responses. Excuse me, I can't remember who used the word ambitious, but when I think of ambition, I think of the idea of moving forward and accomplishing something for your own sake, so you can kind of hang a little ribbon on your own lapel. But as Mark said, and Leah said, it just seems like the process of connecting with a being and entering into that exchange is a beautiful thing. And by its own nature, you would embrace it and just want more. Because I mean, any of us who have maybe done volunteer work or helped a little kid who couldn't quite get something done that they were struggling with, or sat by someone's bedside when they were sick. It's just that connection is just so strong and beautiful, and it just fills you up. And that it just seems to me that that's all it would take to want you to keep going infinitely.
Yeah, I mean, think of not just helping beings, but hopefully we all have had the experience of ending a delusion and how, like, liberating and relieving and refreshing that is. So yeah, like each step along the way, that one being that you just, I mean, that's, I feel like this is, I try to picture like the monks in original Buddhism getting kind of overly serious, and like trying to, meditate really deeply and expunge all the unwholesome impulses and, trying to release attachment to everything and yet so many of our experiences point us towards something that's so much brighter than that. All you have to do is just like help somebody in some small way, and it's just like there's just this wonderful feeling, whether it's a big deal, whether they appreciate it, whether it's even really noticed, right? It's just being able to freely be kind. And and it's just the kind of thing that ripples throughout your whole day. So I kind of pictured, monks being like, "Hey guys, like, this is like once we do all this stuff, we actually open up to something that's really profound and really like connecting and amazing. So let's celebrate that, and let's talk about like Buddhas and jeweled clouds and like make vows to save all beings and." I don't know, it's almost like that all of this kind of arose out of that experience. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. That's one we tend to kind of forget. We're trying to live a generous and kind life. That's good. Trying to end our delusions. That's good. Dharma gates are like, there is so much more that you have not seen. There is so much more I have not seen, right? Like any of us that we have not even tasted or experienced. The world is infinite.
So I'm reading a book called Siddhartha's Brain, which is really interesting, and it talks about the science behind a lot of these Buddhist teachings. And there was an experiment that was done. And they decided that they wanted to see if they could measure compassion, if they could teach compassion. They decided now that's not possible. So they decided to teach to help people meditate, and then they measured frequencies and and EEGs, and they did a whole bunch of stuff. And the one thing that they noticed was they did an experiment where they had people on a crowded bus, and somebody comes in, with a cast, and they noticed that the people who got the meditation and the mindfulness training automatically showed more compassion already, and they were happier people. Whereas they found that people who are angry are not obviously not mindful of anybody around them. They're not happy people. And the more, I don't know if this is true or with for everybody, but the more happy and the more content you are, you can see what's around you, and you have that capacity for compassion. Because I don't think that you can actually teach it, but if you can teach mindfulness and awareness of others, the compassion just automatically comes out. So that was very interesting.
Well, and that brings up the good point that, we, in our practice, we don't have these stages, right? Where it's like, okay, well, now you are working on your own shit. And then when that's done, then you should start thinking about others, right? Like, we're trying to do it all as we go, right? But the truth is that we do have a lot of work to do on ourselves, which is why you can't just, like you're saying from the beginning, just like, all right, I'm not gonna be about myself, but like, it's not something you do just through sheer force of will. And I know from my own practice that even though I had a very fortunate life, like I was mired in my own suffering, my own narrative, and like just I, when I got ordained as a monk, I even told my teacher, I'm like, I don't want to do what you do. I don't want to be a priest. I don't want to be a teacher. I just got to work on my suffering. She's like, okay. And like, I don't know how many, kind of it's a gradual process, but it was, only gradually over the course of quite a few years, like between 5 and 10 years, that it kind of felt like I went from this to like, okay. And I'm like, oh, look at all those people. Like, because when you're, there's less concern and suffering here, we just have more space and receptivity and openness. So, I mean, and it goes both ways. We can try to cultivate that. But, yeah.
Oh, just a quick comment, how we often hear in Zen that, since things like, for example, meditation is not a means to an end, your practice in general is not a means to an end. We're not doing this and we get to enlightenment and then our practice is over. So none of it is it a means to an end. Well, aren't the Bodhisattva vows are just big time extension of that. I mean, because if beings are five, we'll liberate them. I've liberated my five beings and now we're
Yeah,
finished now.
that's done.
That's it. So
Yeah.
and often, very often when you ask like, teachers, how long does the practice go on? And they answer, until the end of your life and then more. So.
And I mean, and sometimes that can sound a little discouraging, because if essentially the question you're asking is, when will my suffering end? And it's kind of like, well, that's going to go on forever. I mean, but that's not really what that answer means, right? Like there can be liberation, there can be growth and development and insight, but then you just got more you can do. So I want to end with a poem. This is Shohaku Okumura's teacher, Katagiri Roshi. Well, not, I guess it's not his teacher, one of his teachers. And wrote a poem on vow called Peaceful Life. Being told that it's impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it's possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. But whichever is chosen, It does not fit one's heart neatly. Being asked, what is unfitting? I don't know what it is, but my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know what a mystery human is. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. From my human eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become a Buddha. But this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells me, yes, I will. Just practice right here, now, and achieve continuity endlessly forever. This is living in vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. And then Okamura has a few comments on this, which I think are very sweet. So he says, Katagiri's comment in the last stanza, from my human eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become a Buddha, reminds us that even though we study the Buddha's teaching, we are still human. The Buddha's achievement is so great that it's almost impossible for us as humans to follow his way. Even so, one vows to practice. In the Japanese version, the word for vow is negao, which means to wish. We wish to practice and aspire to become Buddhas. Katagiri uses the word aspire as the translation for inori. Inori, we've seen, is usually translated as prayer, but here it means deeply wish for something that doesn't seem possible. Even though we know it is impossible to follow the Buddha's way, we deeply wish to make it possible. Then Katagiri says he vows to be resolute. Here the Japanese version has keshin, which means to make up one's mind, to be fixed and determined. Next he tells himself, yes, I will. Even though he feels it's impossible, he cannot help but say this. That vow comes from the deepest part of the self. Intellectually, it seems impossible. But from our deep life force, we can't help but say, yes, I will. That is vow. A vow should not be made up by our intellect or an emotional impulse. It should come from the deepest part of us. So yeah, how about we stand there? Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Parit. Thank you all for being here.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for
It's fine.